Hello and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Afternoon Radio Show on WGXC with your host, Randall Martin. And you know, we like to talk about a multitude of issues on our show and try to get you the best and most informative guests. And this week is no exception. In the 4 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about music and specifically gospel music as well as other music here in the region. And I have the esteemed Mr. Ray Watkins here. And you've heard him on the radio here before. He is an extremely gifted singer, songwriter, musician, but especially in the field of gospel. You have a whole history and legacy, Ray, of gospel music, and you actually come from a musical family. And so for those who haven't heard our previous interviews and don't know you, let's give people a little bit of a background on you, Ray. Just give our audience a little bit an idea of who you are and what you do musically.
Not involved, but I started listening to gospel music 9 months before I was born, I guess, in the womb. And my mom and dad were singers. I'm just the last of the four children. And my three siblings, they all sang either gospel or R&B or whatever. So mom and dad, sister and brothers, friends and relatives, they're all hooked up into this music. So that's where I got my start. When I was growing up, you know, my favorite artist at that time was Ray Charles, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Ray Charles.
The other blind. Famous Ray.
Ray, I wanted to be like that Ray. And so my mom actually was able to send me to music lessons, and you know, back then, you know, that was like in the early 50s, mid-50s, man, $10 a week was a lot of money, you know. So I went to Madame Rose McCrae's music school in Poughkeepsie. but after a couple of weeks, I figured this ain't working, because I wasn't doing anything like Ray Charles, but she was teaching me classical music, you know.
So, well, you got to crawl before you walk.
Yeah, I guess so. But that's where it all started. And after a while, they thought I was good enough to play for at least the Sunday school choir, you know, the children's choir when I was about 10. And so I started playing there when I was about 10 years old. And I just continued to play. I went through high school and, you know, sang and played with, you know, your regular teenage doo-wop groups. I went in the military around during Vietnam, and I got out of a lot of duties because I sang and played for the ship's band for most of my time there. I actually met my wife while I was there. We had a gig in England where she was going to school.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually wooed her with my singing back then. And we are celebrating this year 51 years of wedded bliss.
Wow. So, wow. So, congratulations.
Singing Sam and Dave songs was... seems like it was the key to doing that. So I, but you know, I had a wonderful career. I raised my family, but music just kind of stuck with me. And I was blessed to have met a person like you, to meet you, and got you to help me along the way. So, here you are. Over 60 years later, still trying to sing some kind of tune or play some sort of tune.
Well, it's always my pleasure working with you. I love playing. We play all sorts of music together. We play jazz and gospel and classic. What did One of the singers that we accompany has a wonderful term. Was it vintage soul? It was
vintage. Yes, yes. That was Bryn with the vintage soul. I think she called it that. Yeah. True vintage soul.
And I think that encapsulates it. But also, like me, you know, you play because you love it. I mean, you worked at IBM professionally for many years, retired from that. And so playing was a thing that you were passionate about, that you did. And, you know, you didn't do it as a living, but you did it because you were good at it and you loved doing it.
Yes, exactly. If I was going to get paid, where I'm saying I have to do a lot more work than I did. I worked hard at it, at music, because I love music. I wasn't trying to make a living off of it, although there are places that did pay well, and that kind of helps, you know, family to raise. So anything extra is nice to have. You know?
Well, that's how I look at it too. You know, I enjoy playing well, and I enjoy. You know, the challenges of it and the community benefit, and you know, and certainly, I always like to get paid for when I play, because you know I do it at a professional level, but it is not for the money. It is for the fact that I like to play. It's therapeutic for me to play, but also it is especially fulfilling when you're doing it as part of a musical tradition that is meaningful to you, like gospel music.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Now, what drew you? There are many different types of gospel music, and truly, some of our greatest singers come out of the gospel. I think almost all of them, with very few exceptions, have come out of the black gospel experience, at least early on. Why do you think that is?
What made it was tradition for me. Like I said, I came from a musical family. My dad was a gospel singer back in the early 30s and 40s. And they did come up from the South. And he was... He helped start a group of quartet singers, and they were just kind of like me, you know. They were people that you knew that liked to do this type of thing. So they started this gospel group, and like you, they ended up being broadcasters for gospel. Music. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that kind of wore off on me, and public entertainment is it gives you some kind of a nice high, because you know you're reaching a lot of people,
right?
You
right
know? And the people and your audience is there to hear you. You know, it's not like you're dragging people into to listen to you. So they're really the yardstick as far as how you're doing. Because if they don't come to hear you after they've heard you, then you're probably not doing as well as you thought you were.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I didn't think about that. But you now, wherever you move to, you're being echoed. I hear a bird very prominently behind you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, here's my bird.
That has joined the conversation. And but you also write about the participation of a when you play in church. It's not just you're playing at people, you're playing all for people. you're playing with people because they lift their voice, they sing with you. You have immediate feedback. You know whether it's going good or not. You know instantly.
Yes.
You can tell by the claps or non-claps, you know, people clapping with you, people giving you a face. I mean, it's, you get a sense of how you're doing in real time when you're playing in church. So it's wonderful in when you get a congregation, when you're playing along with the congregation and a song is moving. There is such an exhilarating feeling because everybody is in the spirit and playing and singing, and it becomes just this joyous experience that it's hard to describe, I think, if you're not in music. You know, it is quite a remarkable experience.
Right. Well, I always thought, if you think about it, when you're playing in church, for instance, depending on the type of church you're going to, you're really playing for an audience of one. You're playing for God.
Yes.
And you're not performing.
Yes.
You are playing, hoping that you're going to touch somebody with your music. I like playing at a church, and I like to hear a congregation or choir singing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not entertainment, it's just something else. It's not entertainment. When you're entertainment and you're entertaining, it's a different aspect.
Absolutely.
You're playing to entertain, to get a reaction from your audience. You don't get the right reaction from your audience. They're either just a polite audience or they don't like what you're doing. It's entertainment when it comes to the non-religious type of atmosphere. And it's playing to reach the people, to reach the masses, so that I've actually did a concert one time at Bard College one time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a short story. And there was a young man who was actually, he came to the concert and his head was kind of bad. He had purple hair and he was just sitting there, looked like he had a couple of drinks before he came.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my stronger singers had a lead song that she sang. She came off the stage with her mic and she just sang in front of this young man. And it was almost like she was ministering to this young man.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, she was able to get him somehow. His whole demeanor, everything changed about him that day at that concert.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fast forward several months later, I get a letter from this young man's mother. The name of our choir was called the Thompson Ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
It was in honor of the pastor of the church, Reverend Thompson. Well, the letter was written to Reverend Thompson, but it wasn't. The mother didn't know that Reverend Thompson wasn't at that concert, but she thought I was Reverend Thompson. So she wrote this letter to me thanking me for changing her son's life through that concert.
Mm.
Because after that concert, he was a totally different person. He changed his studies. He went into theology, and I don't know if he's a preacher now or not, but I thought, wow. Look at that, just through that young lady's ministering to song, he changed his life, which was cool, I don't think entertainment usually does that. That doesn't usually do that, but, gospel, Christian music sometimes does that. People do change their lives.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, you know, I will go and play at a concert and people say, oh, we enjoyed that. That was wonderful. And you're just sort of in that moment. It's not really truly transformational. But as you said, I haven't had an experience like that. But I have been and played in a church service where you do see people genuinely engaged in the song at a whole different level. And like you said, it's a you and God experience. And you're playing. I really try to be very much led by the Spirit in playing. It's not like in a concert, I might take a solo, I might do this and all of that. And it is about showcasing my craft and my work musically in a concert. But at church, it's really not. It's like, you know, it's really just following the lead of the Spirit. And sometimes you might be playing something and the preacher might come on and then they are ministering and you might have to stay on the same couple of notes for a while because you're just in that spirit, but something is happening. There's a transformational thing that's happening to people. And I always really, I'm not doing it. You know, I'm just keeping the beat or keeping the rhythm. But something is happening because the people are—they're feeling it, they're reacting, and they are—they're being transformed, renewed. I don't know what's happening in them, but something is happening that's palpable in the church, and I love being part of that. And I feel honored to be in the service, you know, sort of part of God's ensemble that is putting this out into the world.
Yes.
Yes. So tell me, all right, so again, you've always had a professional avocation, and yet you played on the, you know, in churches all the time, as you still do. You still do play on Sundays in church. What keeps you coming back?
The love of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the love of my music. and don't get me wrong, I never claimed to be a great musician or a great singer. But I do like having people like you and other people, very talented people, around me, because actually that makes me better. That makes me more comfortable. I can make mistakes, and you guys cover it up pretty good.
we just follow you. Wherever you go, we follow you.
Yeah, but, you know, there's nothing like improv.
Yes.
Believing. You know, when I follow a script, you know, I'm playing somebody else's music, you know, so I love improvisational stuff. So, because I can change, and if you play with people long enough, they know your changes, and you
right,
know their
they'll change with you.
Yeah, so I just enjoy it because I can do all those things, you know. As a matter of fact, I prefer improv.
Me too.
You know, reading music, and my eyes aren't getting any better, so I'm not that good at reading music anymore anyway. But I think when you have people that have the same or similar types of skills and motivation, it's easy. It is so easy, and the first thing you have to get over, what I found out, is your nervousness.
Yes,
you know, are people going to be critical of what you're singing or critical of what you're playing? Those are the things that used to get me early on when I started playing, because you know when you're a beginner, you know. You're surrounded by a lot of people that's been doing it for a long time. The best thing that you can do when you're around people have been around a long time, is learn from them, you know. But it's hard to get away from that nervousness at first. There's very seldom a time today and that I'm nervous about getting in front of anybody.
You seem so confident. I have never seen you are so natural. And when you get in front, you own your spot. You start playing and singing and you own that area. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, now that you're bringing this to my remembrance, I mean, you would never know. You would never think that you feel self-conscious in any way. You're just such a natural, and people just take to you because you're just in command and in control of the instrument, but the room and the audience. Yeah. And I admire how you do that.
Well, I appreciate that, but I have to be around, like I said, people that are like you, you know, and the rest of the folks that are playing, that are part of it, that are singing, you know, it makes it. It's so much easier. I look at my audience as my friends, whether they like me or not. But that night, they're going to be my friends.
You know? Right.
And I want them to feel comfortable too, because you know, people in those front seats, they get nervous too. They're like, "Boy, I hope he doesn't call me up here to do anything right now." So they're like, just don't bother me, man. You know, don't ask me to come up here and do something. And I wouldn't do that anyway.
Your
audience have to be comfortable too.
Yes. And then, you know, I think when an audience sees you're into it and you're 100% into it, and you're having a good time.
Yeah.
They almost, it's infectious. I think they can't help but to also have a good time because they are in, like, especially if they're close up. They can see it. They can see the authenticity, and they say, "Oh, well, you know, he's 100% into it. He knows what he's doing, and he's doing it." And the thing about, like, when you play, people don't know really what you're going to do before you do it. So you and I, and I think every musicians have, you know, occasionally have dubbed things, missed a note, missed a step, dropped a stick, but you carry on, and you don't. It's like, not only do you not, you can't even acknowledge the mistake because then you get in your own head.
Right.
So, and I always say, like, if you do something that is a mistake, do it again. Now it's a pattern and people won't notice. But you can't become self-conscious and then give a good show. You can't be second-guessing yourself as you're doing it. You got to give it your all and... And they hope for the best.
Exactly. And that is so important because, you know, and oftentimes somebody's paying to come and see you. So you know you have to give them something.
You got to give them something.
You got to give them something that they paid for. You can't, and it doesn't mean you can't make mistakes, because people do make mistakes and they don't even know that they're mistakes unless you bring it to their attention. you know, if you hit a bad key, you know, nobody notices it, you know, unless you notice it, you know. So you just continue on and you give people the entertainment that you promised to give them when you go out there.
Yes. You know, well, you always meet or exceed what I think people expect, because I think there's a level of commitment to that audience. Like, we're there and we're committed to giving you a good performance, and we deliver that. And but that is different than what we're talking about with gospel music. Sort of preface this in the fact that you have been a staple of not only playing gospel, but organizing concerts and being sort of a key figure and gospel concerts in the Hudson Valley for many, many years. And this September 28th is no exception. It's going to be one in a number of sort of annual events that have happened with the Hudson Valley Gospel Choir.
Yes. And I'll tell you, I was really excited about that because it was something that was needed, I thought something that needed. And tourism came to me several years ago and said, hey, how do you like to do this? And of course, you know, well, what am I going to say? No, of course I'd like to do that. And it was an opportunity to showcase the talent that's in the Hudson Valley. Singers, musicians, speakers, dancers. There's such a variety of things that you could do with this music, you know? And of course you think, well, let's do something, you know, that they'll want to see again. You know, you don't want to do something and say, oh, well, that was a mess, you know? You really want to put a big effort into it because the first time that sort of thing was done in this area, although it's something that's been being done throughout the country. But, you know, you really want to go out and give the people something in many ways. Some people come to these things to be entertained, that's fine. Some other people come there to be blessed, whatever. And just, you know, whatever you're coming there for, we want you to enjoy. So that's, this Gospel Fest has been kind of a blessing to us because I was able to reach out to our community and find people that want to do this sort of thing too. Found musicians like yourself who wanted to do this sort of thing too. And it's not a stranger to you and a lot of other people, but it'll go down in history as something that we're able to give back, you know?
I love what you said about, you know, performing in a way to make people want to come see it again. That is such a wonderful aspirational thing. You know, because I'm usually so much in that moment that, you know, I don't really think about that. But it's a wonderful perspective and point of view. And you have also been a curator of local talent. And like I said, when you look and bring people on, you seem to be an attractor for people that are good performers that want to participate. What is it about you that attracts great musicians to want to surround you and participate in your events?
Well, I think just knowing people over the years, I think, you know, my next birthday, man, I'm going to be 75 years old. You know? And
well, you would never know it.
But, you know, you meet a lot of people in those years, and you know, and you form whatever relationship you do form with them, and whatever relationship that I do form with people is genuine. I'm not trying to hustle somebody to do something. I love people. I love being around people, and if I can convince them.
Oh, did I lose you?
Those also, my friends, are, you know, they're getting older and getting slower. But there's always something or someone out there that can keep you going. Like, Mrs. Renee Bailey.
Yep.
And she's, I believe she's close to 90.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, she sang with Peggy Bates. She sang with a lot of people over the years. And I mean, I'm just encouraged by her just wanting to do this. And recently they gave her an award for the years that she did with the arts. But people like that encourages me, mm-hmm. you know, because and I just want to be around her, you know, just to say, hey, man, that could be me one day, hopefully.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, on the downside of it, my age group is kind of moving in a different direction, and they're not youngsters anymore. They can't get up and do like they want to do anymore. And there's not an awful lot of young people that's interested in this kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, I think I need to see if I can find them, because, you know, the pickings are getting slimmer. And I remember being in a 125-member choir one time.
Wow. How do you even manage that? I mean, usually 5 or 6 musicians like herding cats. I don't know what.
And you know, that was, my kids are 50, 51, 47. And we did a concert at the Civic Center, and my kids were about 3 or 4 or 5. And that was just an amazing thing to happen. Now, I didn't organize this thing. Don't get me wrong. I didn't organize that one. But the organizers were able to get 100-some-odd people to do this concert at the Civic Center. The procession was so long that there's like 2 risers full of people.
Wow.
While they were still queuing up down in the basement of the Civic Center. A lot of those people are no longer with us. There's a lot of those people, but, you know, that's passed on, and some are just too old and don't want to do this stuff anymore. They can't do it anymore.
Well, you know, the power of so many people singing in unison, mm-hmm. is phenomenal. You know, to have that the force of all those voices happening and singing in unison. Now add to that the spiritual context of what they're singing, and it really just becomes such a momentously powerful feeling that I think that you can't help but to be totally absorbed in a performance like that with a large audience, with a large choir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had close to 3,000 people at that concert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So there was an interest there. It was a big interest there, and you know, that just encourages people to do something like that, and I think. A lot could be blamed on the decline, I think, blamed on COVID.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people went indoors. You know. So getting young people out there to carry on what was started at one time is a task. And it's not something that can't be done, but it's something that should be done and it should be continued to be working on, because this music is gospel music anyway. It's basically folk art.
Right.
Gospel music is folk art. It's something that's handed down from generation to generation. You know? So it's, you know, it's something that you don't stop just because, you know, something stopped it. Somebody has to want to do it. Somebody has to want to make this effort and do this sacrifice and to get, you know, to get it back the way you want it. Same thing with jazz, blues.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz and blues doesn't change much. The other popular music does, and it's taken over by the generation that exists today. The jazz and blues, that's historic, and it's something that has to be handed down from generation to generation, especially the musicians that are doing it. So
I totally agree.
It's always going to be, in my opinion, always going to be a work in progress.
You know? Now, some people would label gospel music as religious music, and I feel like there are religions. I don't feel like really that's strictly the case. I think that gospel music is often played in churches, but to me, religious implies it's a particular denomination, it's a particular subset of rules. I think gospel music has to follow, by definition, have a message that's centered around God. Maybe it is a refrain from the Bible, or a verse, or it has that as its topic, or you know, within the lyrics are often a psalm. But mm-hmm. I don't think that you have to be religious to enjoy it, to be impacted by it.
Well, you don't. Gospel music, by definition, I guess, is New Testament music. When I say New Testament music, it's about the life, death, and transition of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That's what gospel music is. That's gospel music. It's the good news. That's what gospel music didn't just appear. There was spirituals before that.
Right. Hymnals and spirituals. And yep.
Right. The spirituals are considered the early ones. Well, of course, we call them the Negro spirituals. Those are spirituals I was talking about. And that comes up from slavery, you know. And people like Moses in the Bible was depicted. And Moses was kind of like what Abraham Lincoln was. Moses was getting the children of Israel out of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham was getting the children of Israel out of bondage also. So that was that. But there was also music that was being used for different purposes. There was the Gandhi, the people that worked on the railroad. There was music that was being sung out in the cotton fields. Mm-hmm. There was work music, they call work music, people that were on the chain gang, you know. It all came from some earlier music, you know, some earlier thing. So it all ended up transitioning from one to the other, to the other, to the other. So when they came up with the gospel music, this guy, I forget his name, but anyway, he was a vaudevillian singer, and something unfortunate happened to his family, or family member, and he had to leave the road and go see about the death of one of his family members. I don't know if it was his wife or his daughter. But anyway, he came up with the song "Precious Lord, Take My Hand," that was the they consider him the father of gospel music. But he was a vaudevillian; he was a jazz singer before then. But terrible happened. Something terrible happened to his family. Someone died while he was on the road, and it doesn't pay to get old because the name of the fella is right on the tip of my tongue. Thomas Dorsey, that was his name. Not the drummer, Tommy Dorsey, but the godfather of gospel music, modern gospel music today. His name was Thomas Dorsey.
Oh.
And he's the one that came up with this great thing called gospel music. And that just transitioned and just kept on building up to what's called gospel today. But it came from spirituals. It came from work songs, you know, like the songs on the railroad or in a gospel field or in the field, you know, in the cotton field, you know. So it was all a work in progress, but it all came from the roots, and the roots came from Africa somewhere. So that's where it all started, and the hymnals and things like that that came from more of a, you know, more of a Catholic beginning, or, you know, Anglican. Those songs, since our ancestors weren't allowed there, weren't allowed to read, but we were allowed to sit in some of their services, and they were able to pick up the words. And do their own thing in their own way.
One of the things I noticed about the hymnals is that the hymnals are about the lyrics, and it's funny how the music is almost an afterthought, and even the phrasing, you know, sometimes it's not smooth necessarily. You have elongated phrases to fit the words, and it's not really sort of a repetitive. It's a song structure that you'd find in what we'd say like a modern day song, where you'd have a lyrics and a verse and a refrain and a bridge. It doesn't really follow that to me. And
More classical.
Yes. Yes, and if you are musically in sort of inspired, at least kind of in the way of what I would say soul music, it's the music, the hymnals are often, to me, off-putting because they don't, especially as a drummer, especially as someone who looks at rhythm, they don't really have a natural rhythm as gospel music has rhythm.
Right. Exactly. So, who's to blame for that? That's the drummer. The drummer actually had a lot to do with the music that we could consider black music or gospel music,
right?
Or whatever. The drummer had a lot to do with it because the drummer is basically the person who set the tone.
Yep.
He didn't have a lot of other instruments, you know. So the percussion was a very important part of our music.
Right, and those hymnals often, there weren't drummers. So it was just a piano and a choir, and you'd have all of these kind of interesting, idiosyncratic rhythms that didn't really, that a drummer, like, it's almost impossible to, it's not impossible, but it's difficult to follow it because it's not a traditional rhythm. But as, like you said, as drummers start to enter, be a part of the church, now you start to see a sort of a musical style that's more familiar to what you listen to music today.
Right. So if you take some of the denominations in the church, and I'll use AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church. They did hymnals, hymns from the hymnal, because they are Methodist Episcopal.
Right.
And I always call the Episcopals the watered down Catholics. And it's not a knock on them. But the AME Church is an old denomination, probably the first organized black congregations in America. So they did take on the identity of the Episcopal and the Methodist organization. They're a little bit more sophisticated than the field workers. Okay,
right. But then you get to the AME churches and the Pentecostal churches, And that's what I think when the ball game changes.
Right.
Because then you really, that music is meant to be much more participatory.
Yes, because many of the Pentecostals or charismatic churches back then, they didn't have that pipe organ. They might have had a piano, maybe, but for the most part, it was hand clapping, foot stomping.
Yep.
And that was more natural for our people. So that's where that came from. Before they even had a formal church, they had these campground meetings, you know, and they would do things like call and response songs. And the old deacons back then, they one or two of them could read, actually. So they would take a song like Amazing Grace,
right,
and give it their own spin. You know, the old deacon would line the song, you know, the Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound of a sailor like me. And then the congregation would follow what he was saying, you know.
Right. But you had to interpret it, and it was much more musical in the way that we mm-hmm. look at it now. Yeah. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I do want to talk about the event on the 28th, this great gospel event. Is this this particular series of gospel events, is this the second or third annual, or is it the second annual?
This is actually the fifth.
Okay, all right, so I missed the other one. This is the fifth annual, yes. So
we started inside and made it a three-day event, and almost instantly at the end of it, they started shutting down things due to COVID.
I'm sorry. That's right. This was outside, right? Wasn't this in the park?
Yes. The first one was actually in the Civic Center. It was a three-day event.
Oh, okay.
And then it seemed like almost instantaneously, here comes COVID, and everything was starting to shut down.
Oh, okay.
So since it was a good event, our sponsors said, let's do it again, but, you know, might have to change a few things. So the next year, we did it outside.
Gotcha.
And that was successful. And the next year, we're going to do it outside again, and it rained. So we said, well, we can't have that outside. So we went inside. So we've been inside again ever since.
And it's the Hudson Valley. We're coming down on 1 minute, 30 seconds. So this is the Hudson Valley Gospel Choir. And they're performing on
September 28th.
And how do people get a hold of you? Or how do people get more information?
Well, if you want to give my telephone number, you can certainly give my telephone number. And you can also use my telephone number as a text. For texting. The tickets will be on sale probably in a couple of days. And there are a number of ways that you can get tickets.
I will put the flyer on our WJC calendar, and people will be able to click in, and I'll put a link to the ticket. But that is going to wrap it up for this 5 o'clock hour of the Tuesday afternoon radio show. Thank you, Ray. It's always, always, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you guys for tuning in to the Tuesday afternoon radio show with your host, Randall Martin. Thank you again, Brother Ray.
Thank you too, big guy. I really appreciate you.
You got it. We'll be right back. Love. Hello and welcome back to this edition of the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show. Great you can join us and be back for the 5 o'clock hour. This edition is going to be a little bit different because this show was recorded at the Chatham Bookstore for a book signing for a local author, Andrew Edwards, a great guest, and he's going to be speaking on disinformation. He's been on the show before, and his new book, Army of Liars, is out. And we had a great community discussion, again, over at the Chatham Bookstore. And here is that discussion. Let's take a listen. I know you will enjoy it. I interview a lot of people, and it's a joy to do that because I like to learn. I like to learn from other people's lives, what they do and how they experience life. And how do we really know what's true and what's not true? And with the rise of disinformation, that really was right. In all our conversation, it really brought home that if you don't have the truth as a starting point, then how do you have a conversation? How do you have a country if we're not all sort of approaching the same set of facts? And you were talking about how those facts were being manipulated so that those conversations are now manipulated. Can you explain how that has come to be? I mean, there's always been propaganda.
Yeah.
But how is misinformation as a business model?
Yeah, so you're right that, you know, there's nothing new about propaganda or disinformation or lying or politicians shading things one way or another or being accused of not telling the truth. I mean, this is not new. But what I guess one of the main parts of my thesis is that what has changed is the delivery mechanism. So whereas we used to have these same propensities delivered by, traditional media, the ability to customize the message and target the message to individuals, and sometimes even apparently from individuals, which I can get into later, has changed this from a one-to-many, where it was, you could put a message out there, but you didn't really know what people were going to react to, and you couldn't really, if you were the deliverer of the message, you couldn't really customize it per a very narrow slice of the, let's call it the electorate. But what's happened is that with the advent of two different things, one, analytics, which I do know a little bit about, the study of user behavior and the creation of audiences. So that plus the ability for these platforms to deliver any information that anybody sends them, including disinformation, calumnies, lies, even things that would be illegal in other publishing venues. They have the ability not only to deliver it personally to people who are vulnerable or shall we say persuadable, but, and this is probably the most important thing of all, they can do it with impunity. And that's because of a thing called Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which is a law created in 1996, obviously, in order to protect small bulletin boards back in the day. And those small bulletin boards would have, you know, let's say it was a classifieds. I'm selling a bicycle, call me, right? So you wouldn't, and it would be just like your bulletin board here if you have one. So you wouldn't want the bookstore to get in trouble if somebody came to the bulletin board and put up porno or something. You just so move that over to the electronic side. There were these little bulletin boards. They weren't profitable. They were text only, no promotion, no ads. You know, I'm selling a bike, call me, right? And so they wanted to make sure that people who run these bulletin boards wouldn't be victimized if someone put something crazy up. So they created this law. Well, years later, say, 2012 or so, you see the advent of, I guess Facebook's a little earlier, but years later, they come along and they say, gee, this is a way for us to be able to publish anything that anybody sends us without any responsibility whatsoever. And they created a multi-billion dollar enterprise out of this. And it has created a very unfair and problematic media environment.
Now, thank you. And I want to jump back to something I know about you, and I don't know if other people know this about you, but early in your career, tracking and cookies were a big thing. Now, we all see, like, almost every website you go to, you have to now sign a thing that says you accept all these cookies, which means you accept the tracking. Now, you were early in this, and it's how you're identified and how you're tracked across the net and how they collect this information. Let's talk about this a little bit, because that really sets the foundation for everything else.
So, yeah, the art of, I like to call it an art and a science, because it does require both. There's a lot of technology behind data tracking. You know, I don't know how many people have heard of Google Analytics, but it is a free thing that anybody who has a website can put this code on their page, and they will be able to understand, you know, how many people came, what pages did they go through, things like this. And that's kind of what my company used to do. This was, you know, gosh, 20 years ago now. You know, it was a little bit more primitive than it is now. But the idea was that you could understand your audience in a way that no one else ever could. And I say that because before analytics, there were only a very few ways for even large companies to try and understand their audience. Like, for instance, the Nielsen ratings, which was all about proxy measurements. Like, they didn't actually know what millions of people were watching. They had a panel of a very small, maybe 12,000 people nationwide. And then they would use, you know, mathematics to extrapolate that out into, like, you know, how many people are quote unquote watching. And this proxy measurement was good enough for the biggest companies in the United States to spend billions and billions of dollars on advertising. Okay. When analytics came along, that still is going on. But when analytics came along, it was revealed that, we can now know, not guess, but we can know exactly who went where, looked at what, for how long, what did they click on. And then you take that and you start saying, well, what about all, you know, if we implement cross-domain tracking, which means not only do we now, once you've accepted our cookie, you've also accepted the fact that we are tracking you beyond our website. Okay, you're being tracked by other websites, and we all share the data into one big database about you, and we know everything about where you've been, what you've looked at, what you're interested in. And so what started to happen was the development of these very sort of targeted mini audiences, some of them not so mini, but as opposed to, say, a big advertiser saying, I think I'll take out an ad in the New Yorker because I'm selling, you know, Rolex watches, right? Could I know that they have money, the New Yorker readers, whatever. Very general. Now, let's say a bad actor like a foreign influencer like Russia can say, I know exactly the email addresses that I need to send this message to, and I can guarantee you that they will believe it. And the message is crafted, the message is delivered, and then it's and then they also know, this is also what they know in analytics, who are the power forwarders. If we send it to so-and-so, it's just going to die there. Fine. But we need a healthy proportion of people who will then send it to all their friends, who then believe it because their friends sent it to them, who they trust. And that, so this is what is the world that has been created by analytics.
And from that information, the knowledge that they have on all of us, how does now these companies that now, when you move that kind of information and power to say, I know this about you, I know this is what you do, where you go, maybe you think, the how you think, how do you now, when there are political considerations, to say, and electioneering has been very sophisticated in targeting voters, voting habits, and all those nuances. How do you now take that and move that into the election field where maybe you're a foreign power and you want to influence an election? How can that happen through this information?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways that I can give a couple of examples. One of them is very recent, one of them is several years old. The several years old version would center around the activities of a company called Cambridge Analytica, which you may remember from years ago, where essentially what they did was they created an app called Your Digital Life, and they put it on Facebook. And anybody who downloaded it, once they agreed to the terms, agreed that that app, and by the way, it's not just that app, many apps do this, they will see, you agree to let them see all of your contacts, and they become part of the mailing list. And so they were able to reach a ridiculous amount of people with this. They just developed the most insane email list you've ever seen. And then they turned it over to the Russians. And the Russians started targeting this list with messages in favor of one of the candidates. So again, the recent example also involves Russia. I don't know if you've heard of very recently, the name of the company is Tenet Media, who was recently shut down by the DOJ. I think a couple of you might even got arrested. But in essence, what Tenet Media was doing, they so Tenet Media was essentially paying podcasters as on a 1099, right? As not as employees, but as contractors. They would pay them for their podcast. Now, they would also give them news to put on their podcast, and these people would put that news on their podcast or talk about whatever it was. Well, guess where all these messages were coming from? They were all coming from the Kremlin. And so all these people were spreading this disinformation under the aegis of Tenet Media. Tenet Media got shut down, and some of these folks, I know one of them's name was Kevin Poole, who claims they were shocked, you know, that this was the case. They had no idea. We're, you know, claiming we're victims. Okay, well, that's the recent example. So there's one from a while ago and one from today, but they both accomplished the same thing. They leverage analytics and social media and podcasters in order to deliver essentially fabulisms.
Now, I own the television station, and I know that the FCC requires you to have logs and a lot of different information regarding what you do, who you reach, and all the rest. And I also know that we are an affiliate. What's known as the ION Network today was PAX TV. I don't know if you guys remember PAX TV. PAX TV had a lot of, it's not that long ago, but they had a lot of family-friendly programming, and they became ION. And I use them as my affiliate base because I had worked with the ABC and NBC affiliates in Albany, but I couldn't get an affiliation here, and I couldn't program 24 hours a day. So we used PAX. They were a local channel, and I knew them, and we were able to do that. And well, they introduced you to corporate people, and they probably had 80% of my programming day. And when they sold advertising, I got a piece of it, and that's the way. And then we did the Shopping Channel at night, but I didn't check their programming. Like just like as you said, when you give me an information, they gave me a source, I didn't know if it was true or not. Like they aired it, and that was my airtime, and I'm busy doing other things. You know, they're on. If I ran a news story, I ran it because, you know, it was local and I vetted them, but I didn't vet all this content. But also, one of the things that was apparent to me is that I knew that if we had a misstep, if we said something wrong, if we cursed or, you know, did something that was by the FCC standards inappropriate, we could be fined and we actually could be shut down. And we definitely could be sued. But that doesn't happen to these social media companies.
Right.
They can't fine them.
No.
They can't sue them. And they can't even shut them down. No. Why is this?
Yeah, it's crazy. Happening? It's crazy. I think that, you know, it's actually kind of surprising to me that we're not seeing more people talk about this, but I'm talking about it. Section 230 is the reason. So this law that was made for a completely different purpose has been leveraged now by these, I dare say, members of a trillion-dollar industry who've essentially destroyed all the rest of media. They now own the media landscape, and they're above the law. No one can get to them. And you're right. I mean, if you own a TV station, if you have a book publisher, if you're a magazine, if you're any kind of print publication or broadcaster or radio that uses the airwaves, you are governed by not just FCC rules, which is, you know, those are genuine government regulations.
Right.
But probably more importantly is that you're not protected from lawsuits. So if you go on and you say, you know, Harry down the block is ready to set fire to his neighbor's garage, that would be a problem. Like, you're really not allowed to do that kind of stuff, and Harry could sue you, right? And so that, you know, and corporations react to downsides in a big way. If there's a downside, the corporation has to take that into account. They have to try to avoid getting sued. Because if you look at what happened with Fox News, with the Dominion voting thing, they had to pay $750 million because they got caught lying. Because they're not protected by Section 230. If they had been protected by Section 230, in other words, if they had been Facebook, they wouldn't have had, and the Dominion would have not had any case whatsoever.
And Facebook ran the same stories.
Oh, yeah. And they continue to do it.
YouTube ran the same stories, and they had no ramifications.
No ramifications whatsoever.
No, there's a legal case.
None.
I had a question.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, most members of Congress would know this. So is it just it's taking a long time to get something passed, or like why?
They're not really doing much. I can tell you that I'm a little bit baffled why there isn't more, but I have a feeling like what we're seeing here is a version, not as extreme, but a version of, you know, when I forget which senator it was, he said, you know, the internet is a series of tubes. They just don't, they're not picking up on it. Like, these are, you know, it doesn't take much to confuse people who are not technologists about what, you know, they'll say, well, we're not a publisher, we're a platform. Like, whatever. What is that supposed to mean? It's the public harm that we're concerned about, not like what technology you use. That doesn't absolve you of anything. You still have a, you know, I say you still have a responsibility to the public not to destroy society as some kind of, you know, a side effect of your multi-billion dollar enterprise.
Well, I have a more sinister take on that. And I really feel like, A, lobbyists. Any big company employs lobbyists. So Google, Facebook, any of those large multimedia companies, they have lobbyists that go to politicians and say, oh, under the aegis of the First Amendment, No, we can't be silenced. You know, people should say anything that they want to, and we're facilitating it, and we're just sort of the innocent, you know, conduit of this information.
Right.
But meanwhile, they are monetizing and repeating certain parts of those conversations for their own benefit, because they're inserting advertising in it. So they're not innocent. In my mind, they're culpable.
No, they're also using algorithmically designed promotion. So they'll take they'll find something, and I should say that their entire goal, it's not like they have a dark plan for us. All they care about is that you click on the next thing and stay on the platform.
Right.
The problem with that is that they've discovered, and their algorithms support the kind of the proven fact that what sells best and what keeps people most engaged is outrage and anger and hatred. Mm-hmm. And so their algorithms are tuned so that to create more of it. And we are living in that world now where, you know, obviously we have extreme polarization. We have the kind of polarization that you'd expect to find. Wow.
That's incorrect.
Yeah. that you'd expect to find in a country that had major, major problems. And we don't really have those problems except for the one that I'm talking about. Like, we're not all starving. We're not going to with a wheelbarrow full of dollars to buy bread. You know what I mean? This is a crisis that is avoidable. And Section 230 is one of the biggest reasons why we have it. Yeah.
I don't know. So I'm sure this is a question you were going to ask as well, but sort of about what the alternative is. I mean, not a counter argument to anything you're saying, but just like, of course, there is value in the sort of democratic nature when you're talking about big, like the Arab Spring, like any sort of evolving news story where you do really yeah. benefit from having a lot Absolutely. Of just social media users on the ground instantly uploading things. Mm-hmm. But of course, then really harmful misinformation could be spread that way. Mm-hmm. So what's sort of the alternative?
So I like to say that... My proposal in essentially getting rid of Section 230 or substantially altering it would accomplish a couple things. One, it would create the possibility for damaged parties to sue a social media company if they are legitimately damaged, okay? Not just because they didn't like what was said or they didn't agree. It'd have to be damages, which would come up in court. And what that means too is that after you take away that immunity, there's no further regulation needed. Like it's not the government isn't going to tell anybody to do anything. It's just you take away that, and suddenly you just have a level playing field where all publishers are the mm-hmm. same, where they can all be sued. I'm not saying I'm in favor of being people getting sued, but. If, like, for instance, I'm going to use just an example here. I don't know if anyone remembers a case called Gonzalez versus Google. It was decided in May of last year, went all the way to the Supreme Court. Very briefly, so we may remember the Paris nightclub attacks, 2015. So that was committed by ISIS. They murdered a bunch of people at a dance club. How were those people recruited? They were, some of them, and one in particular, was demonstrably recruited via ISIS's training, like terrorist training videos, which were distributed on YouTube. They and Google promoted them to this person and told them, would you like more? Here's more and more and more and more. Eventually, they were sufficiently radicalized that they went on this mission. And this, you know, the daughter of Mr. Gonzalez was murdered, and he's an American citizen. So he decided to sue Google, which owns YouTube, and his claim was essentially a tort sort of claim, like you have a defective product, your product had a what is called approximate liability for the death of my daughter, which is similar to saying, you know, if the Ford Pinto keeps getting every time it gets hit in the back, it blows up. Ford keeps making the thing, and then people died. Well, guess who's going to get sued? You know, the damaged families are going to sue Ford. So that was his take on it. And it ended up all the way to Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, sorry, you have no case. They're completely protected by Section 230. And I submit that if there was no Section 230, he totally would have had a case.
Now, as you were mentioning, I thought of an example. The amendment, one of my, you know. So let's say... A Facebook user says, a kid says, come to the Chatham bookstore on Wednesdays. All books are 50% off. I went there. I love it. It's a great store. All books 50% off on Wednesdays. So on Wednesday, when you come in, there's a line around the corner. You're like, this is great. You know, you open the door. People come in with a pile of books. Okay, that's $200. Oh, no. It's $100 because all books have. Where'd you get that from? On Facebook. Well, what do you mean? You know, well, that's not the case. But I seen it on Facebook. It must be real. But it's not. So put those books back or pay for the one that you want, right? That goes on all day. And people are leaving because they're pissed now because they wanted double the amount of stuff. You don't have the ability to sue Facebook or the person. Because they're like, hey, First Amendment, baby. That's what I said. That's what I thought. And Facebook is like, he can do whatever he wants. Yeah. So on the micro level, all of this can happen, and we need some sort of ability to have recourse. To say, I had to spend all day taking care of customers because of a deceptive ad. You know. So now, what if that person that did that was your competitor? And they kept doing it. You know, like there's a lot of nuances here. And now when we look at on the political side, where you have people that have now understood this art of tracking you, mm-hmm. understanding who you are, and then how to reach you, and then what subtle levels of deception that we can say about something to normalize that. Mm-hmm. What is that danger look like? Well, you have professionals, not just a kid, but a company yeah. full of people like Cambridge Analytica that yeah. would now be now constructing messages of deceit.
Yeah, so I think one of the things is, you know, what is the believability of the platform? Like, for instance, I think even that maybe at the presidential debate, there was like, they're eating the cats and dogs. No, they're not. But I saw it on Facebook or, you know, something like that. This is, so there's a propensity for people who don't know better to just believe anything they read. Because reading, without getting too far into it, when the printing press was invented back in 1450, there was a long period where no one expected that they would necessarily believe stuff that was printed. That wasn't part of it. It was like there were lots of books published as fact that were pure fiction. But along around, I don't know, the turn of the 19th to 20th century, the notion of fact-checking journalism started to become a thing. So there became generations of people who grew up with the idea that, hey, if it's in a newspaper or a place that everybody knows about, those people have spent a lot of money in developing a reputation for not being full of baloney, right? And so there's good reason to accept what they said. I don't have to do the fact-checking because I trust that they did, right? And so we've all grown up with that. And here comes social media. Social media says, wow, that's cool. They'll believe anything they read. Let's take advantage of that. So they're purposely piggybacking on this notion that we have years of, you know, having real fact checkers in place. They say, well, we're going to do the same thing, except we're going to take away the fact checkers. So now we publish anything and everything with minimal fact checking. And yet people act as if they are doing fact checking when they're really not.
Practically speaking, just given like some of these players would be so small and there's just so many, is it that you believe and they should be required to create another algorithm that would be smarter and ferret it out? Or is it literally like hire hundreds, thousands, however many people, like literally sitting in some room doing it? I'm just kind of curious.
That's a good question. I think until recently, it definitely would have had to have been a lot of people. As AI becomes more sophisticated, that is a legitimate avenue to pursue. Because my feeling is if their algorithms are good enough to decide what's evil enough to put out, and their payment systems are also very, very complicated. If they can do that, they can probably figure out a way to make their platform much more factual just by using AI. I believe they should be able to do it. If they can't do it now, it's within a year or two, they'll totally be able to do it.
You know, I agree with what you say at the end of when you're talking about accountability. Accountability is self-censoring. When I do a video for Malcolm, whatever, and even though I have a long disclaimer at the end, because he might say something and it might not be true. And I'm like, you know, most times it is, but it might not be true. I wasn't there. So I have a disclaimer at the end. And if you write something, you should be, as an adult, certainly accountable for what you do and what you say. I can understand kids, right? Kids may, you know, I was a very precocious kid. And so, and I didn't have social media. So I didn't, you know, I couldn't broadcast my ideas that way. But we know in school, if you're in school and you're a liar, I mean, that's a terrible stigma, right? It's a terrible thing to be called a liar. When we were growing up, not so much today. You can say and do whatever you want, and as long as it has an engagement. You know, if my parents knew that I lied about something to someone, they marched me down, I have to apologize. There were repercussions. If I do it as an adult, there are legal repercussions. Why can't the truth now be elevated, or at least having the convictions of your statements? If you believe it and you want to write it out there, fine. But you got to be willing to take you know, the hit, if it's just not true. So I think how do we elevate conversations to where we're talking about things that we're committed to talking about and going to stand behind them, because there are these people. This is why this book is so important to me. I think that learning about how disinformation is happening around you and how you can protect yourself from it. Like now, I have to look at almost every article. There was an article on Mark Robinson,
mm-hmm.
right? And all the things he said. I was like, wow, this black Nazi. Wow, that just seems extreme. Like, I don't know anybody to say stuff like that. And I was like, okay. I said to myself, how do they know he said this? Because he denied it. So I looked. I did research and I looked. And so their rationale is, there was a porn site in which there is a username, and that username they track back to him saying, it's a person that has your name, uses this name, your email address, and lives in the same town. All right, it's a trail, not a smoking gun to me. I've been hacked. I've had my Facebook account hacked. You know, people may do things vindictively or whatever. That doesn't say to me that he wrote this. They have a trail. So I'm thinking, okay, well, all of that stuff, I kind of have to discount. Then you read about the stuff that he actually said. He said some stuff about MLK. He's a hero of mine. And that stuff I can discount because you said it. I heard you say it. I seen your mouth move. And so I feel comfortable in saying, I don't like that about what you said. But that whole process maybe took 20 minutes. I'm not in North Carolina. It doesn't matter. I can't vote for him one way or another, but I had to fact check it because I heard it and I said, is this true? This is, I think, the level that we have to start employing when we hear something that sounds sensational. Is it true? Because they are depending that you don't do that, that you take it on face value. I heard it. I seen it. It must be true. Like when you were mentioning the early newspapers,
mm-hmm.
I seen a YouTube video that said Ben Franklin was, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a YouTube video that said Ben Franklin actually made the majority of his money. He didn't grow up wealthy. He ran away from his family. He was in an internship or apprenticeship program
mm-hmm,
from
mm-hmm.
his brother.
At a printer.
And he escaped, and they were looking. He was on the lam. What's the right word? He was not absconded. He was a fugitive
mm-hmm.
because he didn't want to follow through. And one of the things he did to make money was he started a newspaper, but like a sensationalist newspaper back in the day, mm-hmm. after printing press. And he made a lot of money from that. Mm-hmm. So all these salacious stories. Now, I did the research. It sounds kind of interesting. And I'm going to repeat it because it sounds interesting. But with the caveat that I didn't do the research. But it sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. So look it up. Look that story up, because I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's how he made his money.
Yeah.
But that's how we're going to have to approach the truth. When you hear something about someone, you are going to have to take the personal onus of saying, is that true?
We do. We are saddled with that.
Yeah. How do we fact check?
That's a big cultural change. I mean, the thing is that you may do that. Maybe a lot of us do that, but certainly not everybody.
We're going to have to.
In the United
States. Yeah.
But how do you make the change?
I mean, maybe it's in schools.
Teaching critical thinking is... Schools are supposed to do that anyway, right?
Yes. But, you know, do they always?
I don't know.
Just research, like in this day and age, here's how you should always be reading the news and so on. And still, not everybody will do it, but at least you'd increase the percentage.
One can protect oneself, for sure, and that'll go a long way. But, unfortunately, the vast majority of people are never going to do any of that fact-checking. And they're just going to believe whatever they read. And moreover, they're just completely unaware that they're being manipulated. Like it's not even something they think about. That is kind of why I think that we have to go to the level of the platform's liability, because they know it's their business. All the other, all the people who, you know, the individuals who are posting things, you're never going to find them. You don't even know what they're thinking necessarily. But the whole point is that what they're doing is they're leveraging a vertically integrated publishing platform. And it's that vertically integrated publishing platform that really should bear the responsibility of, like, what are you putting on your multi-billion dollar publishing platform? And, is it a lie parading as the truth? And how much money are you making off of that as you promote fabulisms to, you know, dangerous fabulisms to the public at large? I mean, this whole thing, you know, with the Haitian immigrants and the eating the cats and dogs. I mean, it originally was somewhere on the internet, and it became viral. And I don't hear Mark Zuckerberg coming out and saying, no, all of that was a lie. He's not doing that.
But are we normalizing this? And that's a nice sort of fabulism. If these are lies.
Yeah, it's a lie.
It's a big word.
Yeah, it's a nice word for lying.
So how do we, and we had this conversation the other day about media literacy. Like, we're not stuck with this. Media literacy is a thing that many other countries teach.
Yeah.
And many other countries don't treat these multimedia companies the same way.
No, they don't.
Let's...
Yeah, so we have a couple things that separate us from the other Western democracies. And this is the root of why they treat the whole media situation differently. So we have two things here that drive it. One is the First Amendment, which other countries, they don't have it. They actually do not have a First Amendment. They don't literally have what we call freedom of speech. They have a lot of laws, interlocking laws that generate, in essence, the freedom of speech, but there's no constitutional amendment or guarantee that, you know, exists. It can be changed, right? They don't have Section 230. This is a U.S. law. So if you're over in Germany or the U.K. or France, they can, and they have told, social media companies, you have to take this down. Otherwise, you're in a lot of trouble. So I was at a conference in the U.K., where I ran into a guy who works for the London Metropolitan Police, and they routinely contact Facebook and others and say, this little thing going on here is a self-harm situation. You need to shut it down now. Otherwise, you're going to have a problem. And he said, well, in the U.S., we wouldn't be able to do that because of Section 230 and the First Amendment. And two, the attitude of American law enforcement, I suppose, is more like it's not in a preventative mode. It's catch the bad guy mode. So wait till it happens and then get the criminal. Whereas his approach was like, we'd rather it didn't happen. And they take steps to rein in some of the worst of the media. And in, you know, Germany and in the rest of the other places here, they have the GDPR, I think it's called, where you can request to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. So their laws are more restrictive. But here's the thing. I don't hear any, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't hear people in these countries complaining that they don't have freedom of speech. In fact, go ahead.
Well, can I follow up on that?
Sure.
I lived for quite a while in Europe, and I've seen exactly what you've talked about. I think it's also linked to our notion of hyper-capitalism. Our sort of belief is that more competition, the better.
Right.
And, you know, it'll work out in the end.
Yeah. The market will figure it out.
The marketplace of ideas and stuff. But does it work in Europe? Do you see this misinformation phenomenon less over there?
I think they are doing more to combat it, but I think they're still being bombarded by it.
Yeah.
But there's a couple different things. One is they're not, the targeting in Europe is less than it is here at this point, certainly because of our election season. I mean, other countries really care about who gets elected here. We probably don't care that much about who gets elected elsewhere, but I can promise you many countries do care about it here. So they have an incentive to try and affect it. But there is targeted disinformation. I just read recently about some in Czechoslovakia where the Chinese have apparently infiltrated some kind of institute there, and they're spreading all kinds of disinformation within a very narrow scope. And people have noticed this, but they're not really sure why. So there's those kind of things going on there.
If I can just follow up,
yeah,
it's also linked to, in my opinion, to the notion of antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
In that, in our country, antitrust, the notion of it is, we're going to go after you if you do either one of two things, if you raise prices or if you limit choice.
Mm-hmm.
And big tech doesn't really do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, they need more choice.
No. Yeah.
The Europeans look at, everybody in Europe knows what the phrase GAFA means. GAFA means?
I'm not even sure I know what
GAFA means. Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Well, but from the European perspective, all these companies happen to be American. So, and they're therefore aggressive. But they view bigness and having too much influence as a problem, not just the impact on how much I pay and how much I pay.
Sure.
And I think the current administration is sort of a little bit heading in that direction, but
a little bit, but in a very, very minor way. Yeah. And this is another reason why I kind of talk about the whole getting rid of Section 230 thing, because I think that it would be, we'd redouble and triple the difficulty we'd have if we suggested that the government should start telling people what they should print or not print or publish or not publish. That, I think, would run into immediate First Amendment problems and probably get scuttled. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you just get rid of their immunity, well, that means the government doesn't have to do anything. And all it does is it means they're just like every other publisher. And then if there's a real problem, it ends up in court.
So which important people does one approach?
I'm sorry?
Which important people would be approached to get rid of this
law? Well, I'm looking at, legislators, like, for instance, our congressperson, our senators, eventually this is going to have to turn into a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, and then eventually there should be a vote. And I'm not saying that I suggest we're anywhere near that, because, it's not really on the radar of most people. Although I will say this, there are people on the right wing who...
I was about to say.
Yeah, there are people on the right wing who oppose Section 230, but for a very different reason than my reason. Because there's two parts of 230. One is that it protects them. They cannot be forced to publish something that they don't want to publish. And the reason why that's in there is because there's this whole carrier versus publisher paradigm. Like, there's the phone company, which cannot tell you what you can say or not say. And then there's a publisher who can decide what they're going to publish or not, right? And so these right-wingers, generally speaking, want to get rid of Section 230 because they want to say, no, you're not a publisher, you're a carrier. You're like the phone company. Therefore, you're not allowed to have any content moderation. You have to publish every single thing that is sent to you, regardless of what it is. And that's why they don't like Section 230.
They want the world to be even flooded with crazy.
More information, more disinformation. So it's interesting that they're coming at it from that angle, but I think if you get rid of the other part, they can still publish whatever they want. It's just that they'll be just like every other publisher.
Right.
But like you say, Congress, they don't care either.
Well, I think they care about the money.
That, right.
And so lobby. And not to be so cynical, but I think that when it really comes down to, when you have elections now, even, let's say, the election here in for Congress here, District 19, both Molinaro and Josh Riley are spending millions and millions of dollars. So the stakes are so high. It's not like these, I think that that's part of it. So who's backing them? Who do you make promises to get the money to run, to make the changes? And then once you're in office, who are you accountable to? Mm-hmm. And I think that has a fundamental lock on making, and also when you're new, and this is something I didn't know, but when you're like a new congressman, you have a vote, but your influence is pretty limited.
Yeah.
You're not on this committee, you're not on that steering committee. It's only the real senior guys that are really playing the game at this high level. And I think that it's hard to regulate, but if enough people say, this is a problem. Like, how many kids have been harmed because of Facebook? How do like my kids think, bro? Like, I feel so lucky that, you know, my kids just escaped that.
Yeah.
You know, that whole social media mess.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, it's terrible.
And in our days, if you were bullied, you were bullied the old-fashioned way. You were bullied in person. You weren't bullied on the net. Now, I'm not saying one is better than the other, but I'm just saying that, in a way, if you had a problem with an individual, you can maybe work it out. But now you have a digital gang of people that are going to follow you around and say terrible things. I can't imagine the pressures that are on young people dealing with something like that than what we had to deal with.
And these platforms are doing nothing to protect them. Absolutely nothing. And it's a terrific shame. I would just... So in order to illustrate, you know, why or how this is so egregious, I often do this thing. I do it a couple times in the book. It's called Take Away the Computer. So if we isolate the behavior and describe it as if there were no computers involved, it kind of reveals the dynamic in a way that I think is very helpful. And so here's my example of how these social media companies are constructed and how they get away with it. So let's say, for instance, that the New York Times, which is not protected by Section 230, they may not be governed by the FCC, but they certainly could be sued for damages, for libel. So the New York Times decides to open up a storefront in Times Square, and they advertise and they say, change of paradigm. Anybody who wants to come in here and type something up, just give it to us and we will publish it, which is exactly what social media is, right? So they say, come on into our little store, type it up, give it to the copy kid. He'll run it over to the press. And then we'll just print it and put it in the next edition of the newspaper. So somebody comes in and they type up an article called Big Bird is Evil and Must Be Killed. And the New York Times publishes it in the next edition of the Times. But not only do they publish it, they do what the social media companies do, which is they send town criers all over New York City looking for people who hate Big Bird or who have expressed a dislike for Big Bird. And they're saying, look, we have an article for you that Big Bird needs to be killed. Do you want? And tomorrow we'll probably have another one. And they just keep doing this and doing this and doing this, okay? A couple weeks later, Big Bird ends up dead. Somebody has murdered Big Bird. And my question is, do we think the New York Times might have a problem? I think they might. But this is what happens over and over again in social media. And it's much worse than Big Bird. It's like people, like kids even.
But what if you printed Facebook? What if you printed your feed on Facebook? You just printed it out and made it available to people. I'm sorry, they printed it out.
If Facebook printed it out,
yeah,
they'd still be protected by Section 230 because they're Facebook. I mean, under present law,
No, if they printed it out and tried to sell,
oh, if they created a newspaper,
exactly,
maybe, yeah, that's I don't know, I haven't thought on that.
You know, I mean, like, it's interesting that the content that is protected in one phase of media is not protected.
No, they might have a problem there. I don't know. They might. Because that's obviously, you know, a newspaper is obviously curated.
Right. And a book. Like, if it just,
or a book. It's probably why they have never done any of that.
Right.
Because, it's a third rail.
The dynamics could go the other way. It's far more likely that the New York Times will stop printing. I mean, the percentage of their information that's read by people who hold a piece of paper in their hand is smaller and smaller.
Yes, it is.
They could, in essence, become a platform.
Right. Would you believe them? But if they became a platform... And let it's a social media platform. Like, if you have a website and you put stuff that's inaccurate or erroneous, you can still be sued. That's not the internet. It's the social media
platform. Yeah, it's them specifically, right.
That gives you that leverage.
Right.
But you talk about a universe of lies. And this is one of your chapters.
Yeah. Well, I think we're kind of living in that right now because of the pervasiveness of it. And so... I go back to, I called it Army of Liars because I feel like disinformation is a form of, is a weapon of war. Okay. I think it's fair to say that the war has already been declared and disinformation is being used to defeat an enemy. That enemy happens to be, well,
the truth.
I don't want to get into politics, but the enemy has been identified, put it that way, and they're looking to destroy the enemy because the enemy is evil. And they actually use language that's very similar to the kind of blood oath language of the Elders of Zion kind of stuff, where they're talking about people murdering babies and eating animals and just all these things that would, if you knew someone was doing that, you'd want to kill them, right? And this is what they're doing. They're making it seem like, oh, those people, you know, those people who live, you know, up in that Hudson Valley, Berkshires area, they're all killing babies and eating pets, and the, you know, they're mad, they're evil and bad. That's essentially their message, and that's how they generate their constituency, by generating hatred for other people. Now, why they do that is open to question. I suspect that it's because they don't have any policies that anybody's interested in, and so they have to think of something else. But
I'm interested in how to change this. And I'm wondering, do you do programs in schools? I mean, to me, it's really another kind of bullying.
It is.
And
it is.
Controlling.
I have been speaking at a bunch of libraries.
And I'd
love to speak at schools, but I haven't cracked that nut yet.
Because if kids understood they're being bullied, I mean, if they got it,
yeah,
you know, especially in high schools maybe, they have to have programs.
I think there should be, and yeah. I'd love to do it, but it's difficult to get people to listen because, I think we're so inundated by it that people have begun to take it for granted.
I know they have to be awakened.
Yeah, I think if you look at mainstream media, you know, even it's ironic because, you know, social media is eating their lunch, right? They're, you know, like for instance, the New York Times has a successful website, but a lot of newspapers and a lot of TV stations are just cratered, you know? And in the meantime, they're all acting as if social media is a force of nature, as if it has some right to exist the way it does. And it's just a strange thing that they've just capitulated so utterly in such a short amount of time. And I just think it's partly because they just don't understand what's going on.
But also they can't compete. I mean, these companies have grown so quickly. And they're multi-billion dollar companies.
Yeah.
And they're worth hundreds of billions. Right. And, you know, these media companies are not, these newspapers and other media forms can't dollar-wise compete.
No, they're not even close.
What would you say that your goal in writing and publishing this book, and what would you want people to take away from it after you read it?
I would like people to take away that it's not hopeless, and that the fix is really, in my personal opinion, really pretty simple. If you get rid of this one law, you immediately level the playing field, and I believe it will have an immediate effect on the behavior of these companies, because right now they're forced to pursue these ruinous outcomes because it's profitable. They are X is not, but the other ones are public companies. If they don't, their investors will sue them. This is on a quarterly basis. They have to pursue the highest profit, otherwise they get sued. And if you deliver to them a downside that you could lose money if you do the following things, this will get corporate attention. This will get shareholder attention, and the whole atmosphere and their behavior changes. Because if you look at any other industry, if it turns out that your company got sued for $1 billion, your shareholders are going to be quite angry. And I believe that's the sea change that would happen and that we need.
Are there a group of you working together?
I'm working on that. I'm working on building a constituency.
Yeah.
But it's very grassroots at the moment, but I'm working on it. The book just came out in a couple of weeks ago, so.
It's like you got one.
What would you like to see? What would you guys like to see in the space? Now that we've kind of discussed it, you've got to have a broad view of what it is. What are your thoughts and what would you like to see or maybe do about it?
I don't know. I mean, I grew up in the 50s mm-hmm. when news came through three networks right. where there were elderly, avuncular white guys, all of whom said more or less the same thing.
Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, Walter Cronkite and the rest of them.
Yeah.
And they're all within 48 to 52% of the middle, right, for demographic reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
And the notion that we have now more choice is probably a good thing. And it's just hard to see the dynamic that reigns that choice in, because, you know, it's just opened up. So there's so much money made in breaking things down so that I come up with a product that, you know, it doesn't attract everybody, attracts you.
No,
that's
no.
your point.
And true. I hasten to point out that getting rid of Section 230 is going to change nothing for all for any website. It right. only pertains to platforms. Because no websites are, no support, like for instance, yeah. Amazon, they're not protected by Section 230. Neither are any other websites,
right.
any big webs. The New York Times, Washington mm-hmm. Post, not protected by Section, so nothing would change for them. The only companies that would be affected are those that invite people to upload stuff and that just goes up and they put their algorithms to work. It's a very specific business model that's developed. That would have to change, but nothing else.
As I mentioned, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say, I agree with your suggestion in terms of a legislative initiative,
yeah.
but I would also say laws like Citizens United need to be, like, so
yeah.
part of the problem is that there is that kind of money, that the election cycle is so long.
Yeah.
If it was shorter, if it was managed differently.
Well, the notion that money that is speech, that's an astonishing leap of faith.
Yeah. And then I hate to say it, but like if the individuals who are running for the highest office in the United States are speaking what I think most experts and others would say are falsehoods, like, It just, the example being set at the top is so bad.
Nightmare.
Like, how do you expect your teenager to tell the truth mm-hmm. when on TV he sees someone lying boldly every day?
Yeah.
And even when said, hey, this was wrong, he doesn't apologize.
They double down.
Yeah. So, and they don't know. I mean, I think to your point, there's so many, like, we're in different media, like sub-media hives, right? So I think there's plenty of people who really, like, let's even use the eat animals, right? Eat your pets and dogs. I mean, that seems so crazy, but let's say it's just a little bit less crazy. If your friend is sending it to you and all these other websites, social media that you're watching, I think these people, some of them truly think that this is, in fact, true, and so they're sharing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Because
yeah. Pizzagate, like, well, I better let my friends know
yeah.
that this horrible thing is happening. I don't think a lot of them truly are necessarily trying to mislead. I think it's repeated so much.
That's true.
I think it's true.
That's true. That's true. That's why disinformation, that's another reason why disinformation is so dangerous, because it gets embedded mm-hmm. in the dialogue. And it just
right.
kind of stays
so
there and gets
down.
Repeated,
right.
you know, or denied. But it's always, it's just kind of out there, you know.
And you have the echo chamber. I mean, it just,
yeah.
people
right.
tune
exactly.
in stuff they agree with. You
know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're all in our own echo chambers, but some of us make an effort to not be in one.
The Chatham bookstore is an echo chamber, right?
So, yeah. Well, as I was starting, you know, I already said, if we can get it closer to the beginning of the problem in education, in schools.
I agree with you 100%.
Because I'm thinking of the case, I know that some bullies who have reformed, they realized, because they didn't realize what they were doing. But once it got clear, they went around and spoke at schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so, and it gives them a real purpose you know, these kids.
That's great,
If they get on board.
Yeah. And, well, I think that's a great idea. Yeah. I mean, I think schools are an excellent place for it.
The parents, they probably have to educate their parents who are thinking.
Yeah.
Well, media literacy is so important, but also repercussions, I believe, changes behavior, right?
Are you any of you teachers? Are you a teacher? I mean,
years ago.
Okay. Yeah, is it feasible to have courses on media literacy? Have courses where you teach kids how do you? I'm not going to tell you what the truth is, but I'm going to tell you how you can find out.
I teach a research essay course. I have in the past at Westchester Community College. We do like a whole unit on, because you're obviously learning the basic research skills of finding solid academic resources. So we do have to add the whole component of like, because this is an article that could be full of misinformation, or this is even like an image that could have been altered online. You can't even trust an image necessarily that it's telling you something true that you want to use in your own work. So it's definitely out there.
But it's at a college, right?
There's also a phenomenon of cynicism. It's not just telling people things that they then believe. It's also transmitting that the Soviets had this notion of nothing is true and everything is possible.
That's called the liar's dividend.
Yeah.
Which is where Steve Bannon picked up on that, He brought it over here. He said, our goal is to fill the information zone with so much shit that no one believes anything anymore.
Yeah.
And that is the liar's dividend, because then lies and truths, it seems even. Right. It seems like, hey, they're, either one could be true because of the way it's been presented, right? And that's another big problem. If you have enough disinformation out there, it reduces the value or the apparent value of the truth, because you can't spot it.
Yeah.
Right. Now, but back to your point about having kids learn early. Like, my granddaughter just graduated kindergarten. Could it be in kindergarten or first grade? Well, I mean, because they're already exposed to, you know, a lot of media by that time. They're on their tablets, they got all these different things. Maybe if we embedded early on these skills on how to research a story. It takes time.
Mm.
Like it takes time to get to the bottom of a truth, and maybe until you know that it is true, you limit the spread of it.
I think that's a great great idea, actually. A children's book about disinformation.
If you do it at kindergarten, it has to be in a certain way, though.
Yeah,
you don't want to scare
them. Of course,
that's right. No, it's more like, you know.
You want to scare their parents, but not them.
Yeah. Right.
So the governor is, you know, on top of these things now with, you know, not allowing you to have a cell phone. Or, you know, that's a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In schools, yeah.
So something's happening.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of major discomfort, but the efforts are not focused enough, in my opinion.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna ask you about results and different things that people you would like to see, or ideas that you have toward this topic.
Well, I think everything has already been mentioned. I can't think of anything else right now.
Yeah. I could read the book.
She's very familiar with the book.
I read the book.
She's sending Instagram posts out about the book.
Got the t-shirt.
Yeah, I think that, like Andrew was saying, every industry is regulated. You know, no one is complaining about it. We all drive on the right side of the road. We use, you know, and remember what was that story you told about the two cars?
In 1897, there were two cars in the state of Ohio, and they crashed into one another.
Right.
And
imagine if the food industry wasn't regulated, if the pharma industry wasn't regulated.
Yeah.
So we need regulation.
Everything's been regulated and no one's complaining about it.
No one is complaining. I don't see everybody,
I can't believe I have to wear a seatbelt. Oh, the safety glass is killing me. You know,
right.
Well, a lot of people just say that.
They did at first.
I can't believe I have to turn on my lights at night while I'm driving. So yeah, no one is complaining about it. So
we're not complaining. Look, another story I tell is, but you know, I kind of a fan of old films, and so I saw this. I guess a promotional film about New York City. It was made in 1964 for the World's Fair. Come to New York City and enjoy the fair. So they had these movies of the New York City skyline. And it was supposed to be like a great day. Well, you couldn't see the skyline at all. Right. It's just like a cloud with some faint images. And I know today if you go, I mean, it's just not that way anymore. So we've cleaned up the air. John, because of regulations.
John Lindsay famously said, I don't want to breathe air, I can't see.
Right, right, yeah. There's, yeah, you couldn't live in New York City if you weren't down with that. But, I mean, the New York City, the air in New York City has been cleaned up a lot. It's same thing with L.A., a lot of places. And guess what? I don't hear anybody complaining about that. And it's regulations. It made everything better.
Elizabeth Warren makes the point frequently that a lot of people who consider themselves self-made success, particularly in high tech, you know, they, you know, drive to work in a road that's paid for.
Right, imagine that.
And they hire people whose education level and therefore their profitability depends on the schools working. And every, you know, we live in a world where nothing
it's
works.
It's interdependent. Yeah, yeah. The notion of totally doing it yourself is always baloney, because you never really, I mean, I'm an entrepreneur myself, and yes, there's I respect entrepreneurs' work. It takes a lot of guts and a lot of risk involved, but the notion that there were no helping hands and society had nothing to do with it is just not disingenuous.
Well, and some of it, I think, revolves around the concept of what do we owe to each other. Not just what we owe to ourselves, not what we have been able to do, you know. And we all stand on the shoulders of our parents and our ancestors. But what is it that we now owe to society?
Right.
And I think that's the existential issue that we're looking at right now. What do we owe to each other? Do we owe the truth? Do we owe civility? Do we owe courtesy? Do we owe respect? How open is open?
Oh, I agree with you.
Can I take that one step further? And that is, to me, the message is not just I owe or
excuse
we
me,
owe.
Excuse me, thank you so much. I just have to be somewhere, but thank you. Thank
We are after six, so if you want to, in absolutely no rush if we want to just kind of transform to an informal conversation.
I've got to go too, but to me, it's not just that, you know, I owe it to somebody else. It's just that my life is better.
Yeah.
If we all have rules.
Well, we need facts. No, like, you know, like, did the Titanic sink or not? You know, there are no alternative facts. Like,
the alternative fact is that it didn't sink. Yeah, that's
right.
A lie.
We need facts.
Well, the problem is this, the passivity that develops comes from being on media all the time.
Yeah.
You stop caring.
People become complacent.
You know, I'm thinking of this book. You know, the people who should read it are, you know,
probably not
going to
give
me
it.
This book. So, you know, how the heck do you reach it?
But I said, you got to read it and then
you got to pass it around.
Or give them out as gifts.
Well, thank you guys.
Amy, thank you so much.
I was going to ask that gracious hope to you.
Yeah, I'm going to stay. I know sometimes people have to leave.
But did you if you look. Well, thank you again for tuning in for this edition of the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show with your host, Randall Martin, and we will see you next time. Thank you for listening.